Post-Harlan Monologics. Number 00037. Recorded on April 4, 2023. Production location, Post. Harlan. Texas. Chapter 37.
The opinions of Maverick 88 are not necessarily the opinions of Maverick 88. Sensitive content warning. Viewer discretion is advised. Trigger warning. This series deals with topics that may be disturbing. Subject matter may include domestic violence, sexual abuse, and subsequent mental health disorders. If you are sensitive to such material, consider entertainment alternatives.
Now, buckle up. You are on the runaway train of thought. Ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, the one, the only, Maverick 88.
One of the biggest records released in 1984 was a Van Halen album called 1984. And you would think that because they chose that as a title for the album, that there would be something significant, something special about that year. And perhaps there was, maybe in your life or somebody else's life, maybe in Van Halen's life, maybe in David Lee Roth's life. But in my life, that year was not very magical. In fact, it was kind of tragical. Really, like the last half of the prior year, 1983, and the first half of 1984, and probably plus the summer added on to that, I have little to no memory of, little to no recall. And this is not like a senility type of thing. I was fucking shit-faced continually during that period of time. And, as I would tell it back then, with good reason. But, you know, in retrospect, obviously, no, there's never really a good reason for that sort of thing. I was dealing with something that I straight up couldn't handle, you know. Up to that point in my life, I'd had some little romances come and go, and, you know, as little as the romance was, as little as the heartbreak was, when I had my first, what seemed big to me, right, I was with a girl for like a whole fucking 6 months, that was a big deal, and truly, that would probably end up qualifying as my high school sweetheart, because I don't recall the rest of the time being with anybody even close to that length of time. It's always a couple of weeks to a month, a couple of dates, you know, shit like that. One that was off and on through time, and if you put all the time together, it probably still didn't equal 6 months, you know. So it was probably like the most significant young love that I had, and it ended horribly, painfully, you know. I caught this girl cheating on me, and My fool mind couldn't reconcile all that. It didn't make any sense to me at all. You know, what she was to me and what she said to me and what we planned together versus what she actually did It was like two completely different things. And so obviously I was living in a lie. And yeah, I couldn't reconcile. She wasn't who I thought she was. And I guess I wasn't who she thought I was neither. And it fell apart. And I suffered miserably, right? And I couldn't deal with it. I couldn't deal with it. So I just buried myself in every drug I can get my hands on. I kind of made my transition out of my psychedelic, the psychedelic part of my life and into the straight up drunken part, you know. Not that I didn't drink prior to that, I did. And I did frequently, but alcohol went right up to the top of my list at that point because that was just a fucking cure all for everything. And it was the easiest thing for me to acquire, cheapest. And I drank and I drank and I drank. And to perpetuate the drinking, I, you know, was into all kinds of methamphetamine and cocaine. That was the year that I was, you know, freebasing cocaine and booting up cocaine, you know, literally lost. There's hard, I have like these little flickers of memories through that time, like stars in the night. And there's not enough to even like draw a line through, put together and kind of get an idea what the fuck was going on. I was gonzo. I was completely gonzo. It is, you know, this entire series has dealt with the idea of like traumatic things that occur to us in our lives. Sometimes we develop a mental block about. And it's like I got this whole mental block for a fucking year. All kinds of shit happened in my life that I really just don't know about. There's some things that I was told along the way, you know, that it's okay. I got a little database entry for somebody told me that this shit happened in my life and somebody told me I did this. And but I don't have an actual memory of any of this stuff, or very little of it at all. But one thing I remember was I was going to school. And I did manage to pull some, like, high school, you know, course credits through. Not a lot. But that year I had a, I was assigned to the very, the school special guidance counselor, right? The guy who was, he had all the hard cases handed over to him. And it seemed that his role was basically, like, try to take these people, kind of corral them a little bit and do what you can to get them through the school and on their way to wherever the hell they're going with the rest of their life, you know. He was a decent guy, you know, he was a decent guy, a little old dude, little tiny like old dude, and you know, white hair and everything like that, come from a whole different generation, a whole different era. And he honestly, sincerely did everything he could to try to help me out in a lot of different ways. You know, it was more than just organizing my class schedules and, you know, working out my credits and things like that. If I was just like off on a fucking emotional jag for whatever reason, I just catch him in the hall and I just say, hey dude, I don't want to go to this fucking class today. And he'd write me a pass to go see him, and I'd go in there and just, you know, shoot the shit. Little things like that, you know, get you through the day. So I have a fond memory of that guy. You know, the memory of that guy predates this lost period of time, that I'm talking, this lost year of mine, and it postdates it also. So memories of him are not necessarily within the bounds, but during that period of time, he was definitely working with me. And something that I recall recently, it was this book he gave me, right? He gave me a book and said, I think this book will help you out. Read it, right? And it was a very different kind of book. Author was Khalil Gibran, a guy from like the 1910s, 1920s. I don't really know his whole backstory or anything like that, but he wrote this book called The Prophet, which was kind of like prose, poetry, weird stories. It was involving this quote-unquote prophet called Al-Mustafa, right? Al-Mustafa. And Al-Mustafa, I guess, was just disseminating his wisdom onto people who ask him about it. And all these different sections of prose had these titles, Al-Mustafa on this and Al-Mustafa on that. And one of them was Al-Mustafa on pain. And he's got a quote, one of the lines within that particular section, saying that pain is self-chosen. Much of your pain is self-chosen, is how it goes, right? Much of your pain is self-chosen. So I had a familiarity with this guy, this book, this character, these quotes, 10 years even before it could begin to matter in my life at all. But what happened some 9-10 years later, right? A grunge band, really kind of a grunge super group, you know, an amalgamation of different parts of different grunge bands got together and made this one album. They called themselves Mad Season, and the name of their album was Above, and it was released in 1995. The principal single from that album was a song called River of Deceit. And in that song, it begins, "My pain is self-chosen," right? And it literally harkens back to this book. Lane Staley wrote the lyrics based on reading this section of this book. And it talks about the idea of pain is self-chosen, right? At least so the prophet says, right? So there's the prophet. The prophet says it. Lane Staley's repeating it. He's got pain, and he's trying to figure out the whole why and what of it all, right? So my pain is self-chosen, at least so the prophet says. And another line, another quote from that section in the book is, "Your pain is the breaking of the shell that encloses your understanding," right? So what that's talking to is the idea of disillusionment that comes with truth. You learn the truth of something like that, and it enlarges you from the inside, and it forces the shell of your limitations, of your limited understanding, to begin to crack and open and fall off so that you can expand and then grow a new shell, right? It's a whole like molting, like spiders and snakes do, right? It's molting and then growth. So it's that process of growth. And the idea is like when you shed the skin or you break the shell, that's what the pain is. And the pain comes from new understanding, which leads to a sense of disillusionment, right? Disillusionment. Let's get out the dictionary and define it. Most of us know what disillusionment is. Let's just put it clear, right? D-I-S, illusionment. Disillusion is to free or deprive of illusion, right? The act of disenchanting, the condition or fact of being disenchanted. I'm going to have to go look at disenchanted now. Disenchant, to free from illusion or false belief. Undeceive, okay? So, in my example of young heartbreak, I talked about this sense I had about this girl, the way she presented herself to me, but then I was disillusioned when I came to see the actual reality of who she was and what she was about. That disillusionment enlarged me, right? It enlarged my understanding, and my greater understanding expanded my limitations and forced the container that held that lie, held that illusion, to shatter that I may grow. So it would be a growing experience. Our pain ultimately is an experience in growing, except in the case where you do what I did with it, which was to bury my fucking hand in this, my head in the sands, actually bury my head in a fucking bottle of whiskey. Smoke myself to death and stick a needle in my arm and all that shit to avoid that pain, to try to pretend that pain wasn't there. And I could tell you what, from that point forward, I was still partying another, 4 years, 4.5, 5 years, something like that. When I got sober is when I started to begin to deal with that heartbreak. So all we do is kick the can down the road. You see what I'm saying? We respond poorly to something traumatic in our life by going to the bottle and going to the pipe and going to the needle. We're just kicking the can down the road. Eventually, we're going to have to deal with it squarely. And the more we avoid it, the deeper we get tangled up in the morass of addiction. You know, the only way to win is to say, all right, here's the pain. This is a good thing. It's going to make me a better man. I'm going to go meet it square on and go see what the future holds for me. It's the only attitude that we can take that's actually worth anything at that point. Right. So there's your disillusionment, right? It's all, your pain is the breaking of the shell that encloses your understanding, right? And in the lyrics, right, the song, that's the quote from the book, and the lyric resonates. A new shell for all to see. Lane Staley mentioned he's going to basically drop his pride, do something different than he would normally do. He's going to break his shell, and he's going to change and grow, and then there will be a new shell for all to see, right? And that's where the applause comes in, because that's good. That's very good. Drug addict as he was, you know, he went right to his grave with his addiction problems. But he had that little moment, that little flash of clarity that was cajoling him to do the right thing. Whatever that situation of pain was for him, or whatever disillusionment had befallen him. So obviously pain is a matter of growth. But what's interesting here, the idea of pain being self-chosen, right? Pain is not only a matter of growth, it becomes, to hear this guy tell it, also a matter of choice. And here's the choice we have. So up front, I'll tell you, I concur. The choice is just as I described it. You can choose to try to ignore the pain, to run from the pain, to escape from the pain. Or you can meet it head on. We escape, we kick the can down the road. And really, it just becomes more painful. And the circumstance that we're in, I don't know if I'm even explaining this good. I don't even know if I have it really all that well thought out. Maybe I don't concur. Interesting, you know? The growth part is a matter of choice. The pain itself, right? It says, my pain is self-chosen. But I don't really see people intentionally choosing pain until they have come to some kind of mental health disorder, right? You can opt to accept the pain rather than ignoring it. But the pain's already there, you know? What choice you make to bring that pain on? Is that to what? Draw the curtain, see what's hiding back there? Perhaps. I'm going to have to say at this point in time, I don't exactly know what this Khalil Gibran dude was getting at with the self-chosen portion of it. But the growth is a matter of choice. You could choose to meet it and grow, or you can choose to ignore it and put off the inevitable, you know? And you can put it off till you die. You can never let it come home, but you'll die avoiding it. Anyway, all that, it's just interesting, right? It's just interesting. There was a connection because I'm speaking this very long monologue, right? With a basis that's relating my years as a burnout to my adult years in grunge, right? The grunge years. And here's like this direct connection, you know, from 1984 Van Halen and whiskey to 1995 to Mad Season and sobriety and trying to meet life head on. You know, I went from that part where I was escaping everything I could to the part where I was meeting it head on. Interesting shit, right? And you know, I look back, I think about all this pain stuff when I'm reflecting on these quotes and these lyrics and everything like that. And obviously, you know, to hear me, you hear that there's been a lot of pain in my life. And the times that were most painful for me were often, you know, way more often than not, an actual spiritual crisis. You know, it wasn't necessarily about emotional incapability, right? Like a psychological incapability of dealing with my own emotions, being too young and immature to have the tools to cope, as I was when I was 15 or 16 and I was addled with this heartbreak, right? I didn't know what to do with that. Now I do, you know, for a long time I have. In fact, when I finally did get over that, that's when I learned what to do about it, right? And it made me stronger for everything yet to come. But I kept putting it off with the drugs until I couldn't do drugs anymore. But yeah, the most painful times of my life were more typically spiritual crisis, not emotional ones, you know? Now, obviously, there's going to be some semblance of emotion tied into spiritual problems. But the emotional response itself is not necessarily the problem. I think the spiritual crisis parts of my life, the big one, the jumping off point, as we call it in recovery, in AA, that's where you can no longer imagine life with or without a drink. And you're just like in this fucking weird limbo place, where you're dead and you're alive and you're neither, and it's all fucked up, but it's a spiritual thing. Now you have to recognize a spiritual problem and accept the hand of a spiritual solution being reached out to you by the fellowship of AA, right? And the longer you spend time in that jumping off point trying to hover in that area, again, the more you manage to delay whatever is inevitable. And that may be a whole new life in sobriety, or it may be institution, jail, and death, trying to persist with your addictions. But that was a big point. You know, the witch story I told you about, of course, that's a breakup, and as emotional as a breakup can be, that was really a spiritual battle the whole fucking way. It was. I was on a trajectory towards God. I wasn't quite there, but I was there in a sense. You know, I was in the fledgling steps of it. I was, cultivating, right? Cultivating positivity is a really good way of describing it. And I used that word, God, with a capital G, as AA handed it to me in step three, right? And you know, other steps too, to describe this positivity that I was cultivating. And I tried to pray, I tried to be connected, but of course when you're not meeting God on God's terms, prayer is a one-way road, and you have no idea what God's response may or may not be. It doesn't come back to you, and you have no sense of it. You have no real personal sense of the presence of God, except, and I've said this before, in retrospect, looking back, you can see where God was with you in your life. Even though at that time you had no cognition of his presence. But yeah, the time with the witch, you know, while I was with her, and the insane period after I got rid of her. That was spiritual crisis shit, you know, that was stuff to get over. Sober-minded, I got over it a lot quicker than I did when I was a teenager and endured heartbreak, you know, deceit, disillusionment, all that shit that came with it and really made it a bad thing. You know, another part was long into sobriety, right? 19 years into my recovery, still not down with Jesus, still not meeting God on God's terms, but at this place I call the shit or get off the pot place. It's an observation that I made. It's kind of been verified and validated, although it's not like anything AA would teach you. It's something AA people experience. When you get up around 20 years sober, if you haven't come to Jesus by that point in time, you kind of get into this shit or get off the pot moment. Now faith in Christ, very specifically, starts to become an issue at hand that you got to grapple with. And I have seen where, you know, a remarkable thing, when I was stuck living up in New York, which is another one of my spiritual crisis times coming next. I, for that very temporary period of time, belonged to a home group over in over the river in Pennsylvania, where there was a prevalence of people who had once had 20 plus years of sobriety and went out drinking and gave it all up, only to have to start all over again. There were like 5 or 6 people in that group that had done that. It was incredible. It was amazing. Because while you see that every here and there, you don't see it all in one place at the same time like that. It was really strange, right? And right around that time, well, no, I was going to say right around that time, I was at my 20-year mark, but no, that's not true at all. I was well past that by then, and I had already come to faith. But I was in Nashville trying to get over what I call the Jesus hump, right? I can accept God, but where his terms involve Jesus Christ, I had a problem with that. Not that I had a problem with Jesus so much, but I had a problem with Christians and Christianity, organized religion, holier than that, all these different excuses you can make for avoiding Jesus, right? While at the same time tending to some semblance of a presence of God in your being and some kind of, you know, your own self-made religion, your own practice of trying to be in communion with that God on your own terms, as it always is, right? But that part was a big deal. That breakdown that I had to make at that 19 going into 20 year mark, the shit or get off the pot, that Jesus hump that I had to get over, right? That was a spiritual crisis. And it wasn't just like that one moment where I finally broke down and came to faith and recognized the hand of God coming into my life for the first time, you know? Not that it was the first time the hand of God came into my life. It's the first time I saw it. You know, I actually saw it as it was happening, and it's been that way ever since. The communion was established at that point in time. But that was a process, you know. That was a good, probably a year leading up to it, and then it was like another year after it. I wasn't writing ahead, but I was making that transition from being like an antichrist who believed in God on my own terms to an actual Christian who was taking God on God's terms. It was a big sweeping change that involved a lot of depression. It was a really rough time, but it was not an emotional jag. It was not the result of some kind of heartbreak or, you know, loss of any kind, grief that I couldn't deal with. It wasn't like that. It was all about this spiritual crisis. And like I just mentioned, up in New York, you know, I had my country life finally after all these years, and when the wheels fell off of that, I found myself in another spiritual crisis. That involved not only losing a life that I liked, right? A home and animals and all kinds of stuff. I lost a family that I had in my household. I lost my own family that I was born into, at least part of it. I lost a job slash career that I was aspiring to and working hard at. I lost all this shit all at once, and I couldn't make sense of it, you know? While there was emotions tied to it, while there was the grief that comes with loss, it was really a challenge, because now here I am, a Christian man, and all the wheels have fallen off and the floors have caved in. And this is that part in life where 9 times out of 10 a person looks up and blames God, right? It's like that Job moment where everything just goes wrong, and somehow you have to keep on trucking, keep on believing in God, that God's there. Why this is happening, maybe I don't know, maybe I don't understand. Maybe someday I will, but none of it matters. The only thing that matters is I stay focused on my faith and I just put one foot in front of the other and do the next right thing and keep on following God and keep on pursuing serenity, right? And you'll end up where you got to end up. And at that moment in my life, I actually did that. I followed through. And it led me back to Texas and into another heap of trouble, which was wife number two, which was another disillusionment moment. Not heartbreak, you know, not heartbreak, not the grief of loss or anything like that, just a puzzlement again. How does a Christian man get with a supposedly Christian woman and have this fucking nuclear bomb go off and destroy the relationship, like, quickly? And at the same time, have a stalker who's going around like spreading rumors about me because, well, I didn't want nothing to do with her. That's a whole nother story, and I should probably talk about that at some point, but not today. But all this shit was going on at one time, and it was another overwhelming thing, which brought all kinds of a major season of change into my life after I had just gone through one. You know, it was just like all of a sudden, within another year, all of a sudden, everything was fucking changing again. You know, it was crazy. Crazy times. But it cleared the decks, and it left me open to the things that were yet to come. And it's been a pretty smooth ride ever since then, right? But these were all these spiritual trials that I had gone through. They tended to be the most painful times of my existence. There are other exceptions, like that old girlfriend that cheated on me when I was 16 or whatever I was when that happened, right? 15, 16, somewhere in there. That was very emotional. Those were emotions I couldn't deal with, you know? That shit would become spiritual when my reaction to it was to blame God, which, of course, with my limited knowledge of God as it was in those days, I was always blaming God for everything. Suicidal, you know, as I was. Living in a mentality of suicidal ideation as I was trapped in. I blamed God for my very existence. I had a nihilistic outlook towards things, you know, at least to some degree, as a kid. But, you know, once you start blaming God for the bad things that happen to you, it becomes a spiritual crisis at that point, because now you're kicking God out. God's a solution to everything that's gone wrong. But when you make him the problem, now you've got no solution to the actual problem. Now, whatever difficulties we encounter, whether they're emotional or financial or psychological, they become spiritual the moment that we want to take up as an adult and meet them head on, right? If we venture to grow and learn, when something bad comes our way, we're just going to nut up and plow through it, you know? And we're going to learn from it what we got to learn from it, And we're going to get spun off in whatever direction it spins us off, and we're going to accept the change that comes along with it. When we venture to grow and learn, all of our difficulties become spiritual matters, and we become spiritually improved. We get closer in the course of righteousness more expeditiously, right? Like I said, it's always, all our problems are out there to be solved eventually. We can kick the can down the road, but eventually we're going to have to deal with it. The sooner we deal with it, the quicker we come to maturity, right? You know, this reminds me of in AA, you know, you got like your birth age. Say you're 20 years old. I say, like, when I went in, I was 21 years old when I got sober, right? I just became legal drinking age, and I had to put down the drink forever. That is to be me, right? Everything's back ass words, but I started drinking and partying on a regular, like, daily basis when I was 13. I had more or less 8 years of partying consistently to that point in time. Now, my age by birth was 21, but in AA, and another thing that, you know, it's not in the literature anywhere, but people talk about it. They say that your actual AA age is going to be your natural birth age minus the years that you were drinking. Because why? The whole time you were drinking, you were just kicking all the cans down the road. You weren't dealing with shit, therefore you weren't growing up. You weren't maturing. Just kicking the can down the road, kicking the can down the road. So when I went into AA at 21, they say emotionally or psychologically, I was a mere 13 years old. I was an emotionally underdeveloped person in a large adult body. But again, it's like AA folklore, you know. But we do regard each other in that light. That is something that I carry around. That is math that I do when I'm sitting in a room. And you go around the room and people are telling you what their AA birthday is, their AA anniversary day, you know. And you look at a guy, he's like 60-year-old looking, and he's like 2 years sober. He started drinking in college. And you do the math, he's like fucking, you know, like 20 emotionally, and he's a senior citizen and shit, right? And this is the kind of people we got running around in this world. There's no shortage of it. There's a lot of people just emotionally set back. But anyway, that's a little off the point. It's within the confines, but it's kind of like stretching the boundaries a little bit. You know, we venture to grow and learn, and then because of the expeditious manner that we address our difficult moments in, we mature rapidly, which causes us to hurt a lot and change a lot, right? Because we start going through life and circumstance at breakneck speed. There's a lot of people that just kind of get in the rut of their existence, and they live in this trench doing the same thing day in and day out. They live in the same house. They drive the same car. They go to the same job. They got the same wife, you know, the same family, the same friends. They sit in the same bar, and nothing changes. It's just the same cycle of everything that just goes on and on and on. With the consistency, you have limited amount of disruption and trauma that comes along, you know, the natural things that come along the way, you know, weddings and funerals, you know. But when you're actually maturing at rapid speeds, you know, when you're meeting all your problems head on, then you're open to change and grow. And this is how it was for me, like AA, the 6th and 7th step. You know, you prepare yourself to live a life without your comfortable character defects, your shortcomings, you give them over to God, and God will spin you off into a whole fucking new dimension to challenge you and break down those bad habits in yourself. This is how I'm 100% sure. I'll say 99, just, you know, to leave a little room for my error, because I've error. I'm very much convinced that that practice in my life had set me off in so many different directions. That's why my life is so meandering and so seemingly unstable, full of change, right? And full of growth. It shows that I was very fucked up and there was a lot of things that needed to happen to change me into the man I've become. But I could say I've not done that particular kind of AA step specifically in how long now? 5 years? And in that period of time, it's been a pretty smooth road. I mean, there's been change in my life, but it was right within the steps that I was going, you know? As I walked, everything just kind of came into place. My path didn't really change. And the big change that happened in my life was meeting my wife, right? And being married, you know, moving in together, establishing a household. That was the big change, but that was all pleasant, right in stride, non-traumatic, non-dramatic, generally speaking. So yeah, I mean, there's something to that spiritual practice of the AA 6th and 7th steps. Really the 7th step, that's when you get down and do it. You turn your character defects over to God. You put them at the foot of the cross, basically, as a Baptist would say, and let's see what he's going to do with it, right? Well, I bring that up because that is the practice of actually begging for change. Sometimes life happens at you and change is forced. Other times you recognize failure in yourself. And this is what AA does in their steps. It tries to create an arena of introspection where you see your failings and you recognize how your failings actually tie into this sort of psychological mechanism that just churns, you know, like a machine, and drives you into all kinds of problems and always threatens your sobriety. It is in itself one of a myriad of reasons to drink. And you got to kind of break the loop of your life, you know, the hamster wheel, as I call it. You got to break that hamster wheel. Jump it. Jump out that hamster wheel. Get off the fucking merry-go-round and make some changes on the ride that you're on. Anyway, you know, like I said before, I mean, you could embrace the change that comes. You can actually call for the change. You can actually bring God into it and just permit God to just do whatever with your life to institute that change, a change that you're actively seeking, right? Or instead, we can bury ourselves in our diversions, right? We can avoid the hurt. We can remain spiritually puny. Because when we talk about growing, we're growing spiritually in these regards. That shell that we break out of with disillusionment, right? That's not just mere knowledge that comes with understanding. There's a real spiritual element to that whole process. Disillusionment is tied to truth, and truth is tied to Christ, who of course is tied to the God of all things. You know, God with us, Emmanuel. A little bit heady stuff right there, but yeah, I said you bury yourself, we bury ourselves in our diversions, we avoid the hurt, we remain spiritually puny, shallow, and even materialistic, right? Our whole outlook, our whole focus becomes on these shallow, materialistic things. And even if we contemplate shallow and materialistic things to their deepest depths, they're still bullshit in the grand scheme of things. You know, they're still bullshit. No, I don't really want to go off too much of a tangent in that, but yeah, you know, kind of boils down to, we had this back in the 80s, and it became common vernacular, but it started, I think, with some kind of like fitness advertisement on the TV. It came up with the slogan, no pain, no gain, right? No pain, no gain. This is what we're doing spiritually. We were looking for spiritual gains. We're going to have to incur spiritual pains. And the two go hand in hand. It's what matures us. It's what takes a child and makes a child into an adult. So breaking the shell that encloses your understanding. So the prophet says. See, this truth now we come to that creates the disillusionment, draws us out of our comfort zone. That comfort zone, that life within that original shell, it's a fucking trap. What are we trapped with? Illusion. Illusion. And what's illusion? It's deception. It's a false imagery. We're living in a lie, trapped inside this shell. And as long as we can maintain the comfort of it and turn a blind eye to that lie, we're pigs in mud. Our contentedness is our devil. And many of us live that way. This is where our creature comforts own us, right? We get in these habits. Like my workday sucks. Right? My mind's got to wrestle with this just like anybody else's, right? I don't like my job. There's so many other things I'd rather be doing with these 8 to 10 hours a day that I'm pissing away here, right? Good things to do. Making the world a better place in so many ways. But here, every good thing I do just gets pissed on, like literally. It sucks. Sometimes, emotionally or psychologically, to get through the day, I need to have something to look forward to when I get home. And I'm no different than you or the next guy. This is how we roll. We don't want to be at job. We're at something we don't want to be at. We're doing something we don't want to be doing, but we know we got to do it. You know, we nut up and grind down and fucking do it. But the whole time we're doing it, we're looking for a reward at the end of the tunnel, right? We're going to survive this 8 hours of suck. And then we get home and we get to what? In my case, the great reward at home would be like eating, right? Just big old dinner. Sitting down with my wife, having a big old dinner, talking about things, and then putting on some kind of entertainment or educational video. That's what I do. I watch, I mention all the time. This past 6 months, I've been into all this, the Star Trek universe in terms of entertainment, but then, you know, the other 3/4 of the shit that I actually invest my time in is learning stuff, you know, Orthodox theology, videos pertaining to, you know, learning my religion better and better, just anything like that, whatever my hobbies are, learning more stuff. You know, I like to learn shit, and I like to do shit, right? I like to learn how to do shit and do it. But I'm talking about creature comforts, right? I can easily get in the habit where my whole life becomes, this job sucks, and then I get home and I eat. And then I get up the next day, and this job sucks, and I get home and I eat. And then if I, like, say there's an event at the church, they're going to start a new class which pertains exactly to somebody like me. I'm going to want to go home and eat, and I'm not going to have time to get up to the church because I got myself in this habit, you know? And that's where creature comforts own us. Our priorities start to get mangled because the rewards we give ourselves for enduring our shitty circumstance outweigh everything else. And anything else that tries to get between you and your reward, you know, between the dog and his bone, is just another shitty circumstance. So in my example now, something I love, learning about Orthodox theology, being at my church, being with the people in my fellowship, all the things, you know, so many of the things that I love, and all the things that are really deeply important to me, because my wife is included in this whole picture, I start to regard as problematic because it's getting between me and my creature comfort. And now the wedge enters into my existence, and I start getting further and further apart from what matters to me and what makes me whole and what makes me centered, right? Makes sense? And we all got this going on. For me, my example is that there. And I don't eat most days. If you listen to me at all, you know I spend more days fasting than I do eating. And it's probably not even close. So I don't get that reward every day. I can't rely on it. And the fact that I fast like that kind of breaks the habit of it all. So I don't get caught up in that rut. But like I could tell you, the winter, you know, I got in the habit of coming home. It's already dark when I get in. Can't really do anything outside. Tired. I just kick off my clothes. You know, 6:45, 7 o'clock, I'm on the couch and I'm done with the day. And now I'm starting to find myself like going to bed at like 8:30, 9 o'clock. And like a year ago, I was up to 12 or 1, you know. Just shutting it down. And my life becomes just a matter of work, sleep, whatever hobby I can accomplish in an hour or two early in the morning before I go to work, and like the hour or two I spend with my wife when I get home from work, whether I eat or not, you know. But that becomes a whole routine pattern until the weekend comes. Well, whatever. I don't want to get too hung up in the actual details of my existence. I'm trying to set an example. Have you look at your own, right? Have you look at your own. Our comfort zones become a trap in that way, and then it separates us from what's actually good and healthy. It becomes a form of idolatry is what it becomes. We start to take on the practice of our creature comforts as religion. Does that make sense? I think it makes sense. Now, some scriptural things, because I can't just mention about like orthodoxy and church in my life without taking this author and taking this music and these lyrics and all these words and all these ideas. I can't talk about all this stuff with kind of just bringing it to some kind of scripture, bringing the Holy Bible, the Word of God, into the matter, at least to some degree, right? I got a dictionary definition, all right? The word disciple, right? Disciple. It's kind of out of the blue a little bit for you. But disciple. What is a disciple? One who embraces and insists in spreading the teachings of another. An active adherent as of a movement or philosophy, right? So you get the idea. You knew this anyway. Disciple. One who embraces and assists in the spreading the teachings of another. So it's a student, more or less, right? A student, but who's also an ambassador of that which he learns. Now I'm going to open the Bible and read from there. I'm going to just take that, just give you an idea of a disciple. We're going to make reference to that word. John 8:31 and 32. This is the New Living Translation I just happen to have open here. Jesus said to the people who believed in him, Jesus said to the people who believed in him, "You are truly my disciples if you remain faithful to my teachings. And you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." Right? And it goes on from there. A little bit more explanation of what's going on, because these people questioned what he was saying. The idea is truth will set you free, and that ties into what we were talking about with this quote-unquote the prophet, and Al-Mustafa on pain, and Lane Staley and Mad Season with River of Deceit. How our disillusionment, which comes from learning truth, grows us and causes a shell around us to break, that we may grow into something larger. Truth begets the understanding, right? The understanding breaks the limitations.
The Down Comes series continues in the next release of Post-Harlan Monologics.
Thank you for tuning into Post-Harlan Monologics. Please understand that this project is meant to be part of a long-term archive as a series of snapshots reflecting a distant past. We are not seeking advertisers, but may at times accept private anonymous donations to help mitigate production costs. Further information involving this project and archived releases of Post-Harlan Monologics can be accessed over the World Wide Web at post-harlan.com and at onsert.com. Comments, critiques, and inquiries may be submitted to Maverick through email at maverick88@post-harlan.com.